This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Oliver Bulla is with us today. He's in London and he's author of the new book, Butler to the World, How Britain Became the Servant of Tycoons, Tax Dodgers, Kleptocrats, and Criminals. Oliver, welcome to On Point.
Thanks very much for having me on the show.
You know, I actually would love to start with sort of a virtual walk down a London street where you are. So take me down, a street in Belgravia or Knightsbridge where, you know, Harrods department store is. If we were walking down the street and we looked around at the very fancy apartment buildings and flats there, how many of them would you be able to point to that were owned by Russian oligarchs?
Well, if I were, say, walking you through Eaton Square or Belgrave Square, one of the really ritziest postcodes in West London, you know, we're primarily talking townhouses rather than apartment blocks. Some of them have been divided into apartment blocks, but let's face it, oligarchs don't want anyone above and below them, so they like to have the whole thing. These tend to be handsome, honey-colored stone, white-painted windows, maybe three or four stories high, with railings out front and, you know, maybe some discreet, tasteful closed-circuit television cameras around the front door. There will probably be in the middle of the square a private garden with a railing around it and a combination lock that only the initiated know the combination for. And it's quiet because not many people live in these houses, right? I mean, they tend to be owned by people who have houses in lots of places. They might have a place in the Caribbean, in St. Bart's or Mystique. They might have a nice villa in the south of France, a palazzo in Venice, you know, and so on. Maybe they'll have a condo in Central Park West in New York as well. It's a pretty sedate kind of place. Now, how many of these are owned by oligarchs? Well, that is the many, many trillion dollar question, because they don't tend to own them in their own names. If you look up on the property registry who owns these properties, you don't find, you know, Vladimir Putin Esquire listed on the deeds, because instead they own them via a company registered somewhere discreet. So it might say, you know, ABC Limited of the British Virgin Islands, or XYZ Limited of Delaware, or, you know, some other combination of inoffensive letters from anywhere from Jersey to the Cayman Islands to Liberia to Mauritius to the Seychelles. There are many different tax havens that will hide your identity for a fee. Yes. But I mean, if we can make this not just a teleportation machine, but also a time machine, I could take your listeners back a couple of days to Belgrave Square, where there was a very amusing, from my perspective, standoff between a small, very small group of anarchists and the forces of the Metropolitan Police. The small group of anarchists had broken into a house that belongs to, as I understand it, members of the family of Oleg Deripaska, a Russian aluminium tycoon who had recently been sanctioned by the UK, which was just following the sanction, the lead of the US, which sanctioned him some years ago. And they'd broken in and decided to, they said, I think the slogan they had hanging from the window was, "You occupy Ukraine, we occupy your house." And they were hanging out there. And it should be said, the police have never paid much attention to the ownership of this house over the last 20-odd years, but they were very interested as soon as some anarchists turned up. So there was 20-odd police officers standing around, quite a lot of journalists, a specialist squad with a cherry picker and harnesses and helmets trying to extract the anarchists who were hanging out on the balcony with their feet dangling into the void. It felt, you know, a little bit less sedate than ordinary West London life, but as protests go, it was pretty genteel.
Well, you know, I asked about that, Oliver, because I have seen some numbers. I think Transparency International says that across London, there's an estimation that there are more than 36,000 properties owned by these sort of shell companies, or at least companies in which it's difficult to directly determine who owns it. And this stuck with me for several years ago. I can't remember who it was. It might have been Peter Aykroyd, but someone had mentioned that there were so many of these properties. You mentioned the quietness of it, that like at night there weren't very, in neighborhoods where there used to be evening life and family life, it was just dark and night and almost at night and almost like a ghost town of super luxury buildings. But, you know, in recent days, we've been seeing those very splashy headlines about assets being seized. And certainly it gives the common person like me a little bit of schadenfreude to see a great sort of red seized word across a super luxury yacht. But that's the end point, right? The property is the end point. What I really want to understand across this hour and why we invited you on, Oliver, is that there's a system that gets that money to the end point in real property. And the system is the problem, right? Because it enables the purchase of a 10 million pound building in central London.
That's right. I mean, sadly, the days are long gone when you could just turn up in a real estate office in West London with a suitcase full of $100 bills and say, what have you got? You know, there are now checks on money that prevent that kind of thing. You can't even turn up with a gold bar, you know, or a private key to a Bitcoin wallet. You do need to actually pay into that estate agent or that legal account from a registered financial institution, which has done all of its due diligence and anti-money laundering checks and yada, yada, and all those kind of things. So the challenge for an oligarch, for a criminal, a kleptocrat, wherever they're from, is how do you get your money that you've stolen from looking like stolen money, looking like a load of dog-eared $100 bills in a hold-all, into looking like legitimate investment into the London real estate market. Fortunately for these people, there is an entire industry that exists to make that work. It's, you know, complicated in its details, but it's pretty simple in its essence, which is that you move money through so many different bank accounts and ownership structures that it's impossible to connect the end product, the final money, from its origin in crime. You know, there are many, many different jurisdictions around the world which will happily move money. Favored ones for the Russians, since obviously this week we're talking a lot about Russians, include the Baltic states, places like Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, which are obviously they used to be occupied by the Soviet Union, so they have strong connections to the two of the countries of the old USSR, or Cyprus. Cyprus is very, very deeply integrated into the Russian economy. Places like Malta. Once it's entered the European financial system, you can bounce it around a bit, maybe move it via Germany or drop it into Switzerland for a bit, maybe send it to Singapore for a little while. They're also pretty secretive. And then finally, it arrives in your London financial account looking like foreign investment. And, you know, we are an open economy. We welcome foreign investment. And by all means, you know, which properties can we sell you, sir? We have a wonderful range this week.
Wow. So, I mean, the analogy that pops into my mind is it's not sort of the clean shirt that matters, but who's doing the washing. But why is it that London, you mentioned a lot of financial centers, but, you know, famously the city of London, the financial center in the UK has drawn this kind of business. And you've written since the 1950s. Why?
Yeah, I mean, London obviously isn't the only place that can launder money in the world. There are many places that will do that. But London is very, very unusual. In fact, I would say unique in the spectrum of services we can offer to the world's crooks and thieves. You know, we don't just launder money. We'll invest that money for you. We will hide that money behind our shell companies. We will protect it from challenge from competitors via our legal mechanisms. We will protect it from scrutiny from journalists via our strict libel laws. You know, we will educate your children. We will you know, register your private jet and so on. I mean, everything is for sale in London. And it is interesting. I mean, this is what the question I seek to answer in Butler to the World, my new book, is how did this happen? How did Britain, how did London in particular and Britain in general start becoming this butler to the world? Because, you know, what we do in helping mafiosi and crooks and kleptocrats sounds like a mafia consigliere, right? You know, you're the kind of person who might help the godfather to get his things done. But Britain, you know, it isn't like that. We're not rough and unshaven and, you know, and sitting around a table in an Italian deli in New Jersey. We're impeccably mannered and well dressed in black tie and tails. You know, and that's what we are. We're a butler. You know, we get things done, but we get things done with manners, as if like we're an extra from Downton Abbey, right? So, you know, how did this happen? Well, I mean, the question is a post-imperial one. You know, London, Britain used to be the biggest bully on the block. We had the biggest empire in the world. What we said went. We set the international rules. But then, you know, after the Second World War in particular, we were broke. We were bankrupt as a country, and we couldn't afford to run an empire anymore. So the empire gradually became independent. Countries became independent. And we were left sort of just as a little island off the coast of Northwest Europe without much significance compared to what we previously had. And so it's a little bit like an aristocrat who has had to sell the big house and the place in town. And he's had to, you know, sell his yacht and his fancy car. And he's no longer a member of all the fine clubs. But he still knows how to do all those things. He still knows, you know, how to integrate himself into aristocratic society. He just can't afford it personally. So instead of being an aristocrat, we started selling, as it were, aristocrat services. Instead of personally being the oligarchs, let's face it, what the British Empire was the biggest oligarch. What Putin's doing in Ukraine, that's what we used to do if we didn't agree with what other countries were doing. We can't afford to do that anymore, so we help other people who want to do it. And you know, we still know how to, we just can't afford it. And so we now monetize that knowledge. It's like if we were in the financial services, you could say we've gone from buy side to sell side, and we used to be very good at buy side, and now we're very good at sell side.
Well, Oliver, stand by here for a minute, because we just have to take this quick break. And we are talking this hour not so much about those, you know, £10 million or $50 million apartment buildings in the United States that are owned by oligarchs and now are in the crosshairs of international sanctions, but about the financial system, the global financial system behind it that does the washing, does the laundering of the money that enables these spectacular purchases, and whether the sanctions, we'll get to this, whether sanctions are doing anything to reform that system. So we'll talk more about that when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And today we're talking about the global financial system behind the oligarchs that allow them to purchase super luxury apartments, condos, flats, yachts, sports teams, you name it, that have now come under the glare of the international community following Russia's attack on Ukraine. So let's listen to a moment to President Joe Biden and what he said about Russian oligarchs who've made billions of dollars off Putin's regime. And here is what Joe Biden said.
We're joining with European allies to find and seize their yachts, their luxury apartments, their private jets. We're coming for you, ill-begotten gains.
So coming for the assets. But again, it's the financial system that created the possibility of purchasing those assets that really deserves some scrutiny. Here's Prime Minister Boris Johnson in the UK, who says that given Russia's attack on Ukraine, Johnson says oligarchs will not find safe financial haven in the UK anymore.
We will sanction Russian individuals and companies of strategic importance to the Russian state. And we will make it impossible for them to raise finance on the London capital markets. And we will open up the matryoshka dolls of Russian-owned companies and Russian-owned entities to find the ultimate beneficiaries within.
Prime Minister Boris Johnson there. And one more. Let me play you a moment from Tom Walker. He's a British comedian who has quite a compelling character, a fictional newscaster named Jonathan Pye. And he's been doing some pieces. He's been doing pieces for a long time, but most recently for The New York Times. And here is how Jonathan Pye says that we, in terms of the world, have got here regarding enabling Russian oligarchs.
While the oligarchs' yachts and villas in Europe have been seized, their London mansions remain untouched. Because the dreadful, terrifying truth is, stronger sanctions against Putin are in danger of hurting us more than it does him. And this was Putin's plan all along. For 20 years, he's been slowly neutralising us as a threat by using our own greed against us.
British comedian Tom Walker there in his character of the fictional newscaster Jonathan Pye. I'm joined today by Oliver Bulla. He is author of Butler to the World, How Britain Became Servant to of Tycoons, Tax Dodgers, Kleptocrats, and Criminals. And Oliver, hang on here for just a moment because I want to bring Louise Shelley into the program. She's a professor of public policy and director of the Terrorism, Transnational Crime and Corruption Center at George Mason University and author of several books, including Dark Commerce, How a New Illicit Economy is Threatening Our Future. Professor Shelley, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
And I have to say, I'm very much enjoying and appreciating the not subtle titles of the books that I get to read today. But Professor Shelley, can we just take a moment here? Could you give me a little bit more of a sort of a how-to in terms of how ill-begotten gains, let's put it that way, from Russia, then enters the global financial system and ends up in the kind of assets we've been talking about. Like, how does that actually work?
It works through a large number of facilitators around the world, lawyers who set up shell companies, individuals who are real estate agents who will sell property to oligarchs. We have a huge art market internationally, and as a Senate investigation a few years ago revealed that Boris Rotenberg, one of the closest friends of Putin, was moving large amounts of money through the real estate, an auction house, because there are not enough protections and transparency in our financial system. So as Oliver carefully pointed out, Maidna, we have the absence of beneficial ownership that allows us to hide who is behind this money, and with great difficulty we can occasionally unravel who are the actual owners.
Right. And so at the risk of asking a naive question, at what point does the dirty money become clean?
When it enters into the financial system, into the banks, into the auction houses, into the real estate, it's been cleaned.
So essentially, the very first transaction within the financial system, because it can go through, as you pointed out, multiple shell companies, et cetera.
Exactly.
Yeah, and the reason why I ask that is it was almost rhetorical more than anything, to make the point that if true reform is necessary here to stop this kind of, you know, kleptocracy that both you and Oliver are pointing at, does it require the reform of the entire global financial system?
It requires reform of the U.S. system and of the international financial system. There needs to be much more transparency, and there has to be not only the decline of offshore havens overseas, but the decline of havens in the U.S. that allow you to register companies and anonymize them.
Right. So Oliver laid claim, he put the British flag down on the place where it's easiest or most attractive for Russian oligarchs to use the financial system this way. Would you like the U.S. to challenge him on that claim, Louise?
I think we can really already challenge them. The oligarchs are not as visible here. They don't own large, visible houses in New York as much as they do in London. They buy apartments in New York, which they rarely use, or apartments in Florida. But they are deeply integrated into our financial system and are using it and have been investing in high tech and are in our venture capital system and our hedge funds. So it's not just Londongrad, as it's been called, but something much more deep and profound in our society.
Okay, so Oliver, let me turn back to you here. I'd like to spend a few minutes with understanding from both of you. When we say it's much more, when it's deep and profound, the impact of this money, what would you say, how would you describe what the impact of it is? Let's start in the UK.
Well, I mean, the impact is you see in terms of obviously far higher house prices. I mean, let's face it, I wouldn't be able to afford to buy a house in the ritzier parts of West London anyway, but, you know, other people would be able to. The house prices are driven up. We also see a very significant chunk of our professional class, which works for oligarchs, for kleptocrats, and that therefore, you know, as it were, sucks talent away from more productive sectors and brings it to, you know, the butler class of people. You know, we see this everywhere, obviously, where there's, you know, very well-developed financial centers. But I think it's more important to talk about the effect in places like Russia or Ukraine. Mm. You know, it's a simple calculation if you are a thief. If you're going to go and steal something, before you do that, you think, can I keep it? You know, otherwise you're not going to bother, right? You're not going to all the trouble of stealing something if you're not going to be able to keep it. What we provide, I mean, particularly in London, but, you know, as not just London, I mean, there are plenty of places in the US that would rival London. I mean, Miami, obviously, but, you know, places like South Dakota provides astonishingly opaque trust structures that I've written about in the past and so on. You know, what these centers provide is a way of hiding illicit wealth. So it's the people who've stolen it can keep it. And that incentivizes more theft than would happen otherwise. So, you know, places like Ukraine have been looted by their rulers over the years. Somewhere like Russia, where half of all the nation's wealth is held outside of Russia, you know, where it's astonishingly unequal, just 500 people essentially own everything in the country. I mean, more unequal than it was before the Bolshevik Revolution. It's astonishing to think about. You know, that has been facilitated, that theft, an epic theft, probably the greatest single campaign of theft that there has ever been. That has been facilitated by us in the West. And therefore, you know, we may not have committed the theft, but we need to recognize that we are at least partially responsible for its continuation and the depth that that theft has gone to.
Yes. And Professor Shelley, I know that this is also something that you wanted to talk about the impact that this is having on Russia and Russians themselves.
I think it's a little more complex to understand what you call the theft in Russia. It's not just stealing state resources. Oligarchs have been choking and taking over businesses that are started by less politically connected entrepreneurs. And it's a phenomenon called corporate raiding. So in 2020, the Ombudsman for Russia, that's an official government figure, was saying that there were 200,000 Russian businessmen in prison because they were placed in prison while oligarchs and members of the power structure were taking over their businesses. And that's in part why so many Russians have moved money outside the country, because nothing is safe in Russia, because there's no rule of law. And it's just the more powerful eat the lesser. But it's also why there's so little entrepreneurship and why Russia has not been able to move away from its dependence on oil and gas, which is why this sanctioning is so crippling to the Russian economy. Mm, mm.
So, you know, of course, let's just state the obvious that this is not a new issue at all. It's renewed in its urgency because of the attack, Russia's attack on Ukraine, and the manner in which the international community is trying to push back. But, Oliver, I'd love to talk about one particular bank here just for a moment, actually with both of you here, because as people might know, Deutsche Bank recently announced that it was going to wind down its operations in Russia. But this is a bank that's been frequently implicated in the very kind of shady operations that we've been talking about. I was looking at an article that you wrote in The Guardian, Oliver, back in 2018, and you pointed out that Deutsche Bank did their own survey in 2015 about discrepancies of money coming into the UK and found that some £130 billion at that time arrived in the UK without being publicly accounted for. But then you asked, did the Deutsche Bank analysts seek to find how that money got there? They could have just walked down the hall and asked their colleagues, but didn't. So tell me more about that.
Yeah, that was a particularly entertaining irony. It is, it's a very detailed piece of research by Deutsche Bank's analysts team about how, you know, money moves through these, you know, secretive channels, how it's not, doesn't end up in the official accounts of the countries publish. And yes, it turned out that their colleagues just down the hall had been involved in this extremely elaborate, called a mirror trading scheme, whereby sort of parallel trades were done in Moscow and London simultaneously to essentially move money from one place to the other. It's a little bit like a very high-tech, extremely high-powered version of the Middle Eastern Hawala system that we heard a lot about in the years after 9/11, which is the way that money can be moved seamlessly from one center in the Middle East to another just by sort of, you know, between a trusted network of financiers. It's essentially worked the same way with Deutsche Bank, just with trading shares. And that's just one of the really big European money laundering scandals that there's been. I mean, Deutsche Bank was what, if I remember rightly, $20 billion. Danske Bank really went one further. They moved $240 billion out of the former Soviet Union, hidden behind UK registered shell companies mostly, and into the West. Other banks, Swedbank, ABLV, did not quite as dramatic, but still very large money laundering scandals, a huge amount of money, as the professor mentioned. Yeah. You know, that the courts in Russia are politicized. They are not, you know, used for legal processes, but it's for punishment. And so, you know, the oligarchs recognize that if they fall out with Putin, as some oligarchs have done, that their assets will be as much at risk as anyone else's. So it's a good reason to get certainly a decent share of their wealth out of the country.
I mean, the numbers are staggering, right? Oliver, you just went through several numbers that are greater than $250 billion in almost individual schemes here. But Professor Shelley, Deutsche Bank has been scrutinized in the recent past for similar activities here in the United States, right?
Exactly. As I was writing Dark Commerce, I kept coming across Deutsche Bank. It was officials of Deutsche Bank not only were facilitating illicit trade and money movements of others, but were one of them was sent to prison for involved in the largest crime that was ever recorded in the European Union, which was the hijacking of the carbon credit market. And in the United States, Deutsche Bank really recently paid a fine of $150 million for facilitating the money movements connected to Jeffrey Epstein, the human trafficker, and how they turned a blind eye to these payments that were going on through the bank for Epstein to pay off his victims, to silence them, and to pay for more victims.
And is Deutsche Bank an exception here? Or if we looked hard enough, would we find similar activities in other major institutions, Professor Shelley?
Unfortunately, Deutsche Bank may be the most notorious, but it's not the only one. There was a leak called Swiss Leaks just last month by a consortium of journalists around the world that looked at Credit Suisse and its facilitation of different kinds of corruption, oligarchs moving their money, theft of resources from around the world. So there are serious problems in that banks are not doing the due diligence that they should be doing and often are prime facilitators of autocratic governments.
Oliver, how much money are the banks making off these transactions and therefore their shareholders?
Well, I think the really big corruption scandals, the big money laundering scandals, such as Deutsche Bank or Danske Bank, Swedbank, have been places that have had, particularly after the big financial crisis of 2007-08, had, you know, some cash flow troubles, had a bit difficulties. And this became a useful profit stream when they were in a bit of a hole. And they didn't really want to ask too many questions about it. You know, I mean, it's not, the Russian oligarchs aren't that rich, right? We're not, I mean, probably Elon Musk is probably richer than all of them put together. Mm. You know, but for a bank that's in a bit of a hole, it's a useful revenue stream. And it can really supplement, you know, what they're making from other places. So, yeah, I mean, it's not, you know, we don't want to overstate how rich the Russians are, but, you know, it's a handy chunk of change.
Well, we are talking this hour about the global financial system that enables the kind of money laundering necessary to buy those buildings, those yachts that are currently being scrutinized or in many cases even seized, the ones that are owned by Russian oligarchs, and the international community's response to Russia's attack on Ukraine. And so when we come back, we're going to start talking in detail about what needs to be done, what reforms need to be made. So we'll have that when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking about the fact that, yes, it has been 2 years since the WHO declared COVID-19 a global pandemic. And we want to look at some of the lessons learned about how to better communicate and lead and act when the next pandemic arrives. So we want to hear from you. Can you think about times where you were inspired or scared or informed or just downright confused by what political and public health leaders were saying at any time in the pandemic? And how did it affect you, how you operated over the past 2 years? So call us with your story at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. That's for tomorrow's show. Today, we're speaking with Oliver Bulla. He's author of Butler to the World, How Britain Became the Servant of Tycoons, Tax Dodgers, Kleptocrats, and Criminals. And Louise Shelley joins us as well. She's a professor of public policy and director of the Terrorism, Transnational Crime, and Corruption Center at George Mason University, author of Dark Commerce, How a New Illicit Economy is Threatening Our Future. Now, we also spoke with Daniel Glazer, who was the former Assistant Secretary for Terrorist Financing at the Treasury Department from 2011 to 2017. And he told us that the kinds of money laundering that Oliver and Louise have been talking about have global consequences.
I do think that this should serve as a reminder to governments around the world that dirty money brings all sorts of bad things with it. It brings dirty influence, it brings corruption, and it winds up supporting activities which are ultimately going to be very, very dangerous to the host governments, whether that's Russian aggression or narcotics trafficking or organized crime or anything else. So yes, I hope that this is a wake-up call to financial centers around the world that fighting money laundering really should be part of how they think about their national security.
And Glazer also told us that because of this money, that money laundering that goes through the global financial system, and there's a great deal of international money in this system, of course, as we know, he warns that truly cracking down on these big transnational banks is a double-edged sword.
The question is, how do you keep the international financial system operating efficiently and smoothly and allow it to benefit all the hundreds of millions of people that it benefits, while at the same time adequately policing it? And that's a balancing act. And I think that regulatory authorities and law enforcement authorities have been struggling with that balancing act for a long time now. I think what this may show us is that we need to really rethink some aspects of that balancing act and make it harder for oligarchs, harder for corrupt foreign officials, or, you know, for our own corrupt foreign officials to access that system. But it has to be done in a smart and careful way that allows the international financial system to continue to operate efficiently.
That's Daniel Glazer, former Assistant Secretary for Terrorist Financing at the Treasury Department from 2011 to 2017. So, Professor Shelley, And Oliver, let's talk solutions now and refocus for a moment, say, just on property ownership. Professor Shelley, in the United States, you know, what could be done? Is there sort of a simple but effective tool that could be used to put more transparency on some of these ownership schemes?
There are many things that could be done. First of all, we could eliminate the purchase of property through shell companies and require that there be open registries of who the beneficial owners are. At the moment, FinCEN, which is our financial crimes unit of Treasury, is suggesting that we have a closed registry, which would mean that it's not available to journalists, to the public, to researchers to understand who is buying this property. And we also do not have any requirements that realtors, brokers, agents report on suspicious financial transactions relating to either residential or commercial property. And they need to be trained in understanding and seeing where the problems are. I remember a few years ago, a real estate agent was telling me that there were properties being sold in Georgetown, a chic neighborhood in Washington, to dead Yemenis. And yet there was no way to report this money laundering in an effective way. Huh. So we need to do a lot to clean up our financial system. And we've been having so much lobbying that's preventing the kinds of measures that are needed to address it.
Okay, so can that be done, though, and not hurt or make it less efficient for legal real estate transactions? Because, I mean, people use LLCs in this country all the time. I mean, Oliver mentioned Delaware earlier, right? For completely legitimate real estate transactions, how to be sure that that imposing more transparency doesn't make it harder for those legitimate activities? Or maybe is it worth making it harder?
You can have companies buy properties, but you need to know who is behind that purchase. I had a building next door to me bought by a shell company that they just let for 5 years until they unloaded the property. They didn't tend to it, and it was totally destroyed. So this phenomena is literally all around us. But it's the requirements in the real estate sector, like in the art sector, are much less than other areas. And that's why they are absolutely magnets for this dirty money.
Yeah. Would this solve the problem, though, of money being moved, say, to a lawyer's account or into a trust first that has trustees and not necessarily owners, and then being used to purchase the real property?
We also need to deal with lawyers and making sure that they know who their customers are and that they are not participating in shell companies that are hiding these owners. We need much more transparent laws on beneficial ownership. That is absolutely number one need at this moment in this country.
Okay, so let's jump over to the UK here. Oliver, from your reporting, I see that, in fact, in the United Kingdom, there have been proposals sort of languishing in dusty corners of Parliament for years now, and all of a sudden they're being fast-tracked. Can you tell us about these proposals?
Yeah, I mean, as Professor Shelley was saying, you know, if you can buy property via anonymous companies, then it makes it very easy to essentially hide the proceeds of theft. I mean, you know, an anonymous company is a kind of weird thing. If you think about what a company is, a company is essentially an insurance contract, right? I mean, your liability for any debts is limited. Society takes on your debts or promises to take on your debts if they go bad in exchange for you engaging in business activity. It's a way of trying to encourage people to become entrepreneurs, saying you won't be ruined if you try a business. You know, it's an insurance contract. An anonymous insurance contract is just an invitation to commit fraud. If you could anonymously insure a house against theft and then burn the house down, then you've no idea who would be the beneficiary and have no idea if someone had been responsible for arson. It is an anonymous company is an astonishing and weird thing that we've somehow got used to without realizing quite how peculiar it is. In the UK, for a while now, we have had an open company registry that you can just Google, I mean, go online and search in its database and find out who owns a company, which was supposed to be a key tool against fraud. The problem is that we did an extremely bad job of implementing it. So there's actually no way of checking the information that is provided. So you could go online right now. Anyone listening to this could go online to Companies House, create a company, pay you £12, and you have a company. You can write anything in the boxes at all. There are some really hilarious examples of people who have really gone for it and created companies in the name of all sorts of things. At the moment, there is a law has just gone through Parliament, which has been, as you say, sitting on a shelf for a long time, which will impose transparency on offshore-owned property in the UK. That's about 87,000 companies in total owned property here, of which about 26,000 are in London. But again, it shares the same problems as the original registry, which is that the information isn't checked, and there are actually lots of ways to evade its restrictions, even if you don't lie. So, doing this right is absolutely central to the problem. I mean, the US, as I wrote about in a previous book, the US company registries are astonishingly opaque. But the Corporate Transparency Act, which I think went through at the beginning of last year, if I remember rightly, will, impose a little bit of order on the US. It's not going to be open, so it won't be possible for ordinary people to just search it.
So the provision you're talking about, that's the economic crime bill that was dealt with or discussed rather hastily last week. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, it received royal assent in the middle of the night, and I think it was on Monday to Tuesday. I rather hope the Queen herself wasn't up at 1 a.m. to give royal assent. I imagine it was done automatically. She's not as young as she was, but essentially, it's called an Economic Crime Act. It isn't really an Economic Crime Act. It's just a Transparency Act, and there's a very bad job of that too.
Well, because you wrote. Again, I believe it was in The Guardian about sort of the London Eye-sized loopholes in this, right? That
I think I called it a colander masquerading as a piece of legislation. Yeah.
A colander masquerading as legislation. one example of which, if you take the offshore company and split it into parts.
So if you own your house via an offshore company, you are supposed to declare the real person who owns that, but. A real person who owns that is defined as someone who owns more than a quarter of it or a quarter or more. So, let's say there are five immediate relatives and they all own a company in equal shares. A person and his wife or her husband have three children. They all own a company in equal shares. None of them have to declare that they own that. Or you could have it owned via a trust somewhere like South Dakota or Jersey or any number of similar tax havens. And the owner is the trust company. It's not the owner isn't the person who's the beneficiary of that trust. There are so many ludicrous loopholes in this piece of legislation. It is dreadful. They have promised a second economic crime bill. Economic Crime Bill 2, this time it's better, I hope. But, as we all know with Hollywood sequels, it is very, very unusual for a sequel to be better than the original. So I'm not hopeful that the sequel is going to solve all these problems.
Well, you also have said that you're concerned that all interest will wane once the sort of initial shock of Russia's attack on Ukraine subsides. We'll come back to that in a second here. But Professor Shelley, again, hopping back over to the United States, so beneficial ownership, transparency there. Do you have another suggestion that the United States could take up here?
I think we need requirements that people have to report on suspicious financial transactions. Almost all the people involved in the real estate sector are exempt from this. If you go to a bank and you're a pizza parlor and you bring in $10,000 in cash, the cashier is required to report that this is a suspicious financial transaction. But this does not exist in the real estate sector. So this is very, very important. And people, if they do not have reporting requirements, will turn a blind eye to a transaction that brings them a large commission. And it's also a problem of real estate developers. They also do not need to look at who is investing their money and who is behind these transactions.
Huh. There is some international cooperation going on, too. I'm seeing here that here in the United States, the Department of Justice, along with their sort of sister organizations in Canada, the European Commission, France, Britain, etc., have a program known as Klepto Capture that seeks to target money launderers and sanction evaders. I can't tell if it was you, Professor Shelley, or Oliver who lightly scoffed at that. was that you?
I scoffed at it. Okay. I was just hearing earlier this morning that the U.S. was helping the French identify who was behind one of these yachts. So there is cooperation going on, But I think the program has been oversold, because if you're lucky, you can seize the property, but it will take years for you. I mean, it can be after you've frozen it to seize it, because the lawyers of these kleptocrats can go to court and contest these seizures by the government. So it's not as if we're immediately taking this property out of their hands. All it can do is ensure that they're not able to sell it the next day to somebody and get their money out of the country.
Mm. So we've got about 2 minutes, 2.5 minutes left here. Oliver, in the long run, is there something about the way the global financial system fundamentally operates that presents a conflict of interest here? That because the money is so good, that ultimately the willingness to reform isn't really going to be there?
I mean, yeah, the issue is that money can flow freely between countries, but laws can't follow it. So if you can move your money from one country to another, then you are suddenly subject to the new country rather than the one where the money came from. And this means that if you're rich enough, you can basically pick and choose which legislation you follow. You know, I mean, I'm the American legal system is extremely good at prosecuting financial crimes compared to other places. The one Department of Justice everyone is scared of is the US Department of Justice. But if you can get your money out of the reach of the US legal system, stick it in Britain, stick it in Switzerland, stick it in the Maldives, then it's going to be pretty much safe from anyone prosecuting it. And that's the real issue. I mean, kleptocapture is a silly name, to be honest. I don't know why they chose it. But if it does lead to much more transnational and international cooperation against this money that moves transnationally and internationally, then that's really good. You know, I've been heartened by Joe Biden's White House and what they've done about this. And I'd really like it if some European capitals started doing the same thing. But, you know, the issue is baked into how globalization works. So we need to act in a more globalized manner if we're going to be able to tackle this cash.
And Professor Shelley, just a last thought from you, because you know, we obviously have been focusing on Russian oligarchs and their money. And in a sense, also because of what Vladimir Putin has just terribly decided to do in Ukraine. But is this problem of the global financial system enabling money laundering bigger than Russia, that it's something that's used by, you know, autocrats around the world, and it enables them to then, you know, make the decisions and lead the way they do in their countries?
Absolutely. This problem has been brought to the fore by the Russian situation in Ukraine and the terrible devastation that Russia's wreaking. But the problem of autocrats from all over the world, from Asia, from Latin America, from Africa, laundering their money into the global financial system and into the U.S. is leading to the export of corruption from there to us and undermining and destabilizing the global order. Mm. And we've seen this terribly in the last few weeks.
Well, and as you've noted as well, Professor Shelley, in response, we may be seeing sanctions, but not necessarily the flood of legislation that's needed to make long-term change here. But Louise Shelley at George Mason University and author of Dark Commerce, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Meghna.
And Oliver Bulla with us from London, author of Butler to the World. Oliver, thank you.
Thanks, Meghna. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.